So in today's section, what I'd like to do is really talk about processing for next-generation networks, talk a little bit about the major trends that we see in how networks are evolving, what kind of technological competencies are going to be required in the next few years, and then talk a little bit about Cavium products and how we have developed products to address these next-generation requirements. So before I start, I just wanted to give a quick corporate update on who Cavium is. We are a fabless chip company that was established in 2001, so we are about 4.5 years old. We are still a private company, a world-class engineering team, a very strong patent and IP position. We are headquartered in Mountain View, California, with a chip design center entirely in Marlborough, Massachusetts, a software co-development center in Hyderabad, India, and an Asia-Pacific sales office based out of Taipei, Taiwan. So though we are a small, fabulous company, we truly have a global footprint. We have put together, over the past 4 years, an industry-leading portfolio of intelligent processors for security, networking, and communication processing. We have a rapidly expanding customer base, over 100 customers worldwide, and our chips have been designed now into something like 200 different boxes in various types of networking devices. Very strong financial position. We've raised over $60 million in venture capital from blue chip VCs. Our leading investor is Menlo Ventures out of Sand Hill Road in California. We are tripling our revenues year over year, and this year will be no different, and we expect to hit profitability in the first half of the year. So with that quick update on Cavium, before I really started the presentation, what I really wanted to do was give you a quick networking 101 course. 60 seconds, and by the end of these 60 seconds, you'll know everything you need to know about the network. So essentially, a network operates on 7 different layers, layer 1 to layer 7. Layer 1 is the physical layer. Layer 2 is the Ethernet layer, and at this layer, all you're trying to do is it does switching here. So essentially, you're inside your corporate network, you're sending an email within the network. This is able to do the switching from point A, source address, to destination address. Then the next layer up comes layer 3. And here, this is the IP layer. And in this IP layer, what it allows you to do is communicate in between networks, not just within the LAN, but in between global networks. Then you have layer 4, which is really the TCP and UDP layer. And what this layer really does is it ensures that communications are reliably done at layer 3 and layer 2. So, for example, if you do a traffic congestion, a packet is dropped. At this layer, you will resend the packet. So this really ensures reliable communication. Layer 5 and 6 is really the application session layer. So essentially what this allows you to do is to have reliable communication between two applications running, one at the source and one at the destination, for example. And finally, you have layer 7, which is really the application layer where you run all your applications. CRM, email, all those type of applications are run at layer 7. So if you take a look at traditional networks, which were primarily deployed in the 90s, essentially you had your enterprise where you had your local area network, you had a data center, maybe a server load balancer, and you were connected to the core through an edge router. Also, you had home and mobile users using dial-up connecting to an access router, which allowed them to access the resources of the enterprise. And then also, you were connected to business partners, regional remote offices, all through edge routers, which connected to the core. So if you look at traditional networks, all they did was layer 2, layer 3, and layer 4. So essentially, there's a source address, there's a destination address. Where did this packet come from? Where did this have to go? That was pretty much the range of the first wave of Internet 1.0 deployment. And the services that were required for these traditional networks were essentially layer 2, layer 3, and layer 4. So essentially, reliably transmitting packets from a source to a destination. Then as the network became much more, became used more and more by enterprises, a security layer was added on top of this traditional network. And what this allowed you to do is it allowed the enterprise to extend its borders beyond that of the physical location. So now you could communicate with remote users in the home, with mobile users on the road, with branch offices, and with business partners, and all of them could now connect securely. So a layer 2 to layer 4 security overlay was added on top, which allowed communications using virtual private networks, using SSL, and in the wireless area, using wireless LAN security. So essentially now, anybody, anywhere in the world could communicate with the resources of the enterprises securely. And the services for these networks were pretty much for data services. You have your same layer 2 to layer 4 services. But now, with security services, you also added layer 2 to layer 4 security services, which included having IPsec VPNs, which is basically authenticating the user, encrypting the data as it flowed over the net, and also using things like stateful firewalls to prevent intrusions. So if you take a look at that network infrastructure and see, during 95 to 2000, the network infrastructure was being built out. So the winners from the communication semiconductor market were the Broadcoms, the Marvells, the PMCs of the world that basically supplied layer 2 to layer 4 silicon. So they supplied files, they supplied switches, they supplied MACs. And essentially, if you take a look at the four pieces of silicon that were used, there were five. Broadcom and Marvell were the dominant people in those five. Then there were the standard layer 2 switches. And here you had Broadcom and Marvell again come out with a whole bunch of layer 2 switches for that need. And then you had ASICs, FPGAs, and network processors. And all these essentially did was layer 2, layer 3 packeting, packet parsing, and forwarding. Very, very simple operations. And here you had companies like AMCC, which got AMCC, Intel, and Cisco that made silicon for this. And then finally, at the application layer, since there were not many applications really running, all you required was a very, very simple embedded processor, a single core, simple CPU that essentially did management and control, because there were not many applications running on the network at that time. So to address this secure infrastructure, Cavium came out with two sets of products. The first was a line of security processors, and these essentially are single chip solutions, which do all the packet processing, all the encryption, decryption, authentication, all the things required to either decrypt a packet or to encrypt a packet. So essentially, you had the standard routers doing their thing, and when a secure packet came, it would be shoveled off to our processor that basically, you know, did the packet processing, did the decryption, and gave a clear packet out back to the host to continue to do what it was doing. And we came up with an entire line of products from kind of the low end, 100 megabit, all the way up to 10 gigabit, and these are either used as coprocessors sitting off a main general processor, or in line cards, this would be used as totally inline processors. So you had a 5 max security processor, NPU, and switch fabric. So essentially, a single function security processor that handles all the aspects of layer 2 to layer 4 security. And our main value proposition in this particular market was we have today the industry's broadest security processor family from low end to high end, which is shipping in production today. The architecture itself, earlier on, security was done basically as ASIC or hardwired logic. But we were the first company to actually make it into a programmable processor where new protocols, as they came, you could add to that. So, for example, we started off this processor releasing it to do VPN and SSL, and when wireless security 802.11i came on, we could seamlessly add that on without having a forklift upgrade. And also, it was fully software compatible, so very, very easy to deploy. The next set of products that we did were actually single-chip solutions for the broadband, wired, and wireless infrastructure. So in the last couple of years, the rates, for example, for wireless have gone up from 10 megabits with 802.11b, and they're approaching now 100 megabits plus with MIMO and 802.11m. So we came up with a single chip with an embedded MIPS processor, MAX, security engine that does all the broadband routing at 100 up to 100 to 200 megabits line rate, but also it does security at line rate. Up till now, most of these broadband processors used to do standard routing at 100 megabits, but as soon as you turn on security, the performance would drop. drop down to 10 megabits level. So these processors are now being deployed in ADSL2 plus type infrastructure, in the FTTP in Japan, fiber to the home, fiber to the premises equipment, in VDSL, very high-speed DSL, and in the cable infrastructure. So this is essentially a single chip. So this would sit, for example, in your house or inside your SOHO or SMB type box. So it's a chip, memory, PHY, and that's pretty much about the whole box. The single chip pretty much did all the routing, all the processing, and all the security at line rate. So now let's see what is happening in Internet 2.0, the next generation network. And Internet 2.0 is coming together very, very quickly. And instead of having just simply secure and dumb networks, the network is evolving to become a content-aware and secure network. So what does this mean? So we have I've shown you what the secure layer 2 to layer 4 Internet 1.0 network look like. And now all of a sudden, you've added a whole bunch of new boxes. And what they essentially do is the network is becoming more intelligent and more content-aware. So instead of just doing layer 2 to layer 4 services on the data side, you will now be doing layer 4 to layer 7 services. So intelligent applications running which are content-aware. For example, in Internet 1.0, you did not care what the payload was. You had a source address, destination address, switch from point A to point B. In Internet 2.0, you're not only concerned with the entire header, you are concerned with the entire payload also. So now switching decisions and routing decisions are not only based upon source and destination address, they are based upon the actual content. And this is a very, very big change that is occurring as we speak. So a server load balancer, which is just pure load balancer, that load balanced among four servers, for example, is now becoming a content-aware server. So, for example, the purchase orders that are coming in, it will look at the payload and switch it to the payload server, which has very, very fast response. If somebody is looking just for web pages download, this will be aware of what the payload is and make intelligent decisions based upon the payload than the header alone. Also, a whole lot of extra layer 4 to layer 7 security is being added. Earlier on, it used to be just IPsec, SSL, just secure communication. But from extending of the enterprise securely, the next problem became perimeter defense, which is defending the enterprise against outside attacks. So now a whole bunch of new boxes are needed, intrusion detection boxes, network antivirus boxes, all these boxes that make sure that the right person is allowed to access the right resource for the right reason inside your enterprise. So now if you look at it, instead of just doing layer 2 to layer 4 for data services, you've added layer 5 to layer 7 services, which is content-aware switching, routing, filtering, load balancing, mirroring. For example, if you want to do URL-based filtering, you don't want to allow www.playboy.com to be accessed from your enterprise, you do it that way. You want to make sure that MP3 streams, for example, are not being downloaded in the enterprise. You can do that. You can now look for keywords. For example, you can scan all the emails, and if there is a particular word you want to look for, which is confidential information or a bomb or whatever the word is inside the email, these services are able to actually find it, and then they can quietly keep a copy of it and do with it what they would be doing with it. Also, on the security side, you've added not only now stateful firewalls, now you also, since you also are really bothered about the content, not just the header and the payload, you are really looking now at very, very deep packet inspection. That is, you're looking at the entire header, you're looking at the entire payload, and you're looking for attack signatures, you're looking for unlawful usage, you're looking for unauthenticated users, you're looking for viruses, you're looking for spam, you're looking for phishing, you're looking for all those things. And all those things follow into layer 4 to layer 7 services. So all of a sudden now, the simple dumb network that used to route is becoming a very intelligent, content-aware network which really needs to address these high layer 4 to layer 7 services. Another caveat of this is that for layer 1 to layer 3, the functionality was pretty well set. You know, there was a few things, 20 things, 30 things, functions, that you needed to do in a router box. So you could go ahead and use components that were not very programmable, that were just configurable to handle this limited set of functionality. But once you go from layer 4 to layer 7, now you need to run applications, you know, a myriad of applications. So what you really need is extreme high levels of programmability, general purpose operating systems capability, a lot of processing horsepower, and a lot of specialized hardware acceleration to do all these specialized functions of layer 4 to layer 7 at line rate. So what do you do in layer 4 to layer 7 data services? This basically reads and interprets messages at the application level instead of at the packet level. Content-based switching and routing. So for example, to receive a customer order in one email, but you convert it and route it to three different departments, the credit department, the sales department, and the shipping department, without any human intervention. Data center load balancing based upon contact. Like I said, orders, you know, going to one server versus general purpose inquiries going to another server versus email going to a third server for different levels of priority. Then you have application level QoS. Provide priority based upon the packet data rather than just the source. So here again, you need to do very deep packet inspection. And then content transformation, transferring packets from one application to the other. And on the security side, SSL VPN is one of the applications. Intrusion detection and prevention, inline detection of hacker attacks, and real-time response. Anomaly detection. So for example, if a certain anomaly in the usage model is detected, access to a bank line or to an ATM at 2 a.m. in the morning is an anomaly for that particular user. So keeping all these usage patterns and being able to see when transactions occur whether there is something strange happening in there that needs to be flagged. Gateway antivirus. Right now, for example, the first generation of antivirus, it was at the endpoint. But at the endpoint, if the virus has already reached your computer, we believe really it is too late. So actually going ahead and moving antivirus to the edge of the enterprise is the right way to go, because normally that one box is easier to control than 10,000 PCs, which, you know, one guy may have forgotten to get the latest signature. So this is much, much more manageable. Anti-spam, anti-phishing, and content-based filtering. So today, to do this type of secure content-aware network, the current silicon choices that you have, you know, the PHY, the switch, the ASIC NPUs, and the weak general-purpose CPUs are not good enough to be able to deliver this at the price performance that is really required for mass deployment. So, for example, at the high end, to implement a function like this, you'd require a myriad of processors. You require switches. You require Macs. You require the standard microcode-based NPUs. You require maybe a TCP engine. You require security processors. You require control plane processors, general plane processors. And all of these processors require memory, and they consume power. So to deliver any kind of decent performance at higher line rates, it just becomes too expensive, too high of power consumption, and too much board area. So what Cavium has come up with is their next generation of products under the brand name of Opteon, which is a secure network services processor family that integrates all these layer 3 to layer 7 functions with end-to-end security into a single processing chip. So for example, this processor has lots of compute MIPS for general purpose, using general purpose instruction sets for general purpose applications. For example, each of these high-end chips that we are shipping today has 16 64-bit CPUs on a single chip. You know, we have x86 world just coming to two cores or two 64-bit processors inside the chip. We are already shipping processors with 16 64-bit CPUs. That is 10 gigahertz of embedded processing power available under the hood. 20 billion instructions per second. So this big farm of CPUs can be used to run all your applications. And it uses standard OSs, Linux, VxWorks, and it runs standard C software. So you have an application running on your x86, you can move it to this processor very, very seamlessly and quickly. It is a very network-centric architecture. So the whole architecture of this processor has been designed to understand the language of packets rather than the language of control plane for which it was primarily used. So instruction set enhancements have been done to add data processing capabilities, to add security capabilities, and content parsing capabilities to the standard MIPS ISA, for example. And it has gigabit Ethernet interfaces directly on chip. It has hardware support for the traditional network functionality. Layer 2 to layer 4 packet handling is built in right at the interface. And then we have support for layer 4 to layer 7 packet services. So, for example, we have 16 deep packet processing engines within each chip that are able, as soon as the packet comes, to start parsing the payload, compare them to viruses, compare them to intrusion signatures, compare them to content that you're trying to block out, and they run at several gigabit data rates. Then we have a compression decompression engine. So, for example, if you have an email attachment that is compressed with gzip, right now the virus can be very easily embedded in that, and unless you decompress it and open the packet, guess what? You'll never be able to find the virus. So we have compression decompression engines on board, TCP acceleration engines on board, pattern matching and pattern parsing engines on board. All this as co-processors to this big farm of 16 64-bit CPUs. And on top of that, we've added layer 2 to layer 7 security. That is VPN, SSL, intrusion detection, and antivirus. So so if you can imagine, a compressed encrypted packet comes into the chip, gets decompressed, decrypted, authenticated, so now it's in the clear. It gets parsed for content, it gets parsed for viruses, application gets run on it, and finally it is sent to the right destination, all in the confines of a 40 millimeter by 40 millimeter package. That is an enormous amount of processing power for these network applications and security. So we put together an entire family, so you have a 16-core version, an 8-core version, a 4-core version, a 2-core version, and a 1-core version. So it will take you from kind of the couple hundred megabit performance all the way up to 10 gigabit performance. The only difference is in the number of cores. Software is identical, so one software development will allow the end customer, our OEM and ODM customers, to come out with an entire family of boxes from, you know, a few hundred dollars in price to tens of thousands of dollars in price, with one base software and one base hardware architecture. So the way we see the network evolving now is, instead of these four components, the PHYs, the switches, the MPUs ASICs, and the general purpose control plane CPUs, that there will be a lot of integration, and we believe that two basic components are going to take a lion's share of the TAM for networking. One are going to be the switches. Initially they were layer 2 switches, but now they're adding some layer 3 and some layer 4 functionality onto it. So layer 2 to layer 4 switches, which are really intelligent switches, and then you'll have multi-core CPUs with hardware acceleration for layer 3 to layer 7 services that will go ahead and be the other big component. So finally, we have now gone from multiple different architectures, each architecture addressing one functionality in the network, to a general purpose CPU, multiple cores, standard OSs, standard ISAs. And we believe this will be the ignition point where truly a network processor can become the general purpose x86 of the network and really become a very, very standard component. So multi-core CPUs with L3 to L7 will become the workhorse microprocessors for the next generation. So Cavium Networks today we are the leading supplier of standalone security processors, a world's fastest and broadest product line, and 9 out of the top 10 security box vendors, Cisco, Juniper, SonicWall, all these companies today use security processors from Cavium. We are also a leading supplier of mid to high-end secure integrated communication processors that go into the broadband infrastructure and provide routing and security at line rate from about 50 megabits to 200 megabits of performance. And finally, with our new family, we are soon becoming the leading supplier for embedded multi-core processors. We have tremendous momentum and several tier one OEM designs in this area, and we believe that this will be a major portion of our revenue moving into 07 and 08. We have a rapidly expanding customer base. Pretty much all the major networking companies and security companies use our chip, from Cisco to Nokia, Symantec, Netgear, Yahoo uses our cards inside their servers to provide secure access for logon. Netgear, Fujitsu, SonicWall, so pretty much a very, very wide range of customers. And only about 20% of our customers are now in production. Design cycles vary from about a year to 2 years. So over the next 12 months, we'll have a lot of these boxes going to production. So we see a very, very healthy revenue run rate moving forward. So this is a quick summary of where Cavium sees the network evolution and what type of product that Cavium is building to address these new requirements.
Please welcome Eli Fruchter, President and CEO, EasyChip Technologies.
Good afternoon. I have a good news and a bad news. The good news, let me start with the good first. I did not use nanotechnology on my slide, so you will actually be able to read the letters. I use big letters. The bad news is that you will have to read it because most of you will not understand my Israeli accent. So I want to start. EasyChip is a provider of network processors, and just in a few words I want to tell you what my vision of network processors is. And first, what is a network processor? So actually it's a processor, but it's a processor that was designed specifically to deal with networking products. Now I believe that like Pentium in PCs, eventually all networking products will have a network processor inside. That's the first step. Then if we go one step further, I believe that unlike today, where every systems vendor like Cisco, Juniper, you know, each one is building its own box, I believe that when we go furthermore into the future, there will be a standard box. I call it NP, networking platform, like the PC, if you like. And those network platforms will be built by companies that will do just that, like Dell build PCs, companies that are called EMS, Electronic Manufacturing Services companies, will build those boxes. The system vendors will buy the boxes from them, put their software on it, and sell it to their customers. Well, we are not there yet. Network processors are just starting. It's a young market, but I believe that where it's going to go in the future. Before network processor became available, people build their product based on ASIC. So every company developed their own ASIC, put them inside the product. ASICs require very long design cycles. They cannot catch up with the dynamics of the internet, so they have to be redesigned time after time, especially now with triple play, with carrier type Ethernet. So lots of changes are required in ASICs. So they cannot provide a solution anymore. And in NPUs, since they are programmable, it's very simple just by programming them to add all those additional features. So I believe that NPUs will take over ASICs as time goes by. Now, I want to talk a little bit about services versus line cards. When you look at, you know, at a big box, there are many slots there. Most of the times you have one slot for services cards. And that's where NPUs are mostly used. Those are the cards that will do all the advanced services, including security. Now you have the line cards. The line cards are the ones that are found in all the other slots. So you have about 10 line cards for every services card. And those line cards are where the ASICs are. And the question is really, can NPUs go from the services card, one per box, into the line card, 10 per box? And to answer that, I want to look at silicon process. And, you know, as you know, as we go from 130, 180 nanometer to 150 and on, the size of the transistor becomes much smaller. And actually, we can put a lot more logic. Or, with much less logic, we can do exactly the same functionality. So you need less logic, less silicon to do what you need to do. And then you have the IOs or the pads. Those are the things that connect the chip to other chips. And the IOs are analog, and they're almost the same when you go from one technology to the other. So now there is a situation where we have two types of chips. If you look at your left-hand side, you have chips that are core-limited. That means that you have more logic, and the logic actually dictates the size of the die. Where on the right-hand side, the IOs dictate the size of the die, and that's head-limited. Now, network processors used to be core-limited, so they were big chips. Now, with 130 nanometer and below, they are becoming head-limited, like ASICs. ASICs need less logic because they have less functionality. So, in all silicon technologies, they cost less. But now, when we go to 130 and below, actually, ASICs and network processors cost the same. So, at 130 and below, actually, ASICs and network processors cost the same, and I believe that that will enable network processors to go into the line card. Now, EasyChip wins through integration. We are actually now coming out with our third generation chip. The first one, which is the MP1, we integrated two of the major elements or parts that exist on a line card. On the MP2, at 130 nanometer, we actually made our first step in replacing ASICs on line card. So that's a chip that exists. We received samples of that. It's working. And soon it will go into production. Then our next step is the NP3. The NP3 will be another step in integrating all the line cards, all the line card elements into a single chip. And actually, the NP3 is a line card on a chip with all the elements on it, and we believe that that will continue to replace ASICs and actually will take us from carrier line cards also into enterprise line cards, where cost is even more important. Now, what the experts have to say about EasyChip. So, Linley Gwenap is a guy that is an analyst. He covers network processors, and he says that EasyChip is established as the leading vendor in 10 gigabit network processors, focused on metro and high-end enterprise applications. That came out in November of 2004, and he expects 10 gigabit NPUs to comprise 30% of the 2007 NPU revenues, and EasyChip could capture half of that. Now, last month, in a live reading article, Linley said that Intel and AMCC studiously ignoring the high-end market and letting EasyChip run away with it. So the good news is that we are running away with it. The bad news is that there is not much to run away with. At least not for now. So the market for 10 gigabit network processors is still young, but we are winning the design today, which will translate into revenue in the future. Now, Intel and AMCC are mentioned here. Intel, AMCC, and Agere are the three big players in network processors, but none of them have a solution for 10 gigabit. So they are in the lower speed network processor. The others that that play in the high speed are startups. Then I have another expert that said something about EasyChip. You know, George, EasyChip is no longer a venture investment. It's a reproving winner. My best pick since Qualcomm. I'm blessing. In the world of network processors, EasyChip Inside may soon become as ubiquitous as Intel Inside has become in microprocessor world. And that was a year ago. And look what happened last month. Show me the money. Patience. So the way that things work in with network processors, maybe that's a good timing to tell you about that. Once a customer is picking our network processor, then they start to design. They design, you know, their product, and the design like that could take around 2 years. Let's say between 18 to 24 months. So now they have their product, they put it in market, takes another year for the product to ramp up. So from design win to production, ramp up, it's about 3 years. So revenues that we see now are design wins that we had 3 years ago with NT1. NT2 is our first chip that goes into the line card. Design wins that we are seeing today, actually we started to get our first design wins for the NT2 over a year ago, so it will take another year until those products go to production. A little bit of the background on the company. So EasyChip was founded in 99. It's a spin-off from a public company by the name of Lanoptics. I actually founded Lanoptics back in 1990, so 15 years ago. It became public in 1992. It's a company that used to do boxes, systems, but then we spun off EasyChip. And today, EasyChip is Lanoptics' only asset. Lanoptics sold 60% of EasyChip. So you have an anomaly here. EasyChip is a startup, but since it's owned by a public company, all the numbers are reported because that's the only asset of Lanoptics. So the numbers are consolidated, and therefore we are actually a publicly traded startup, a very unique situation. We have 80 people. We raised over $60 million. Last 10 were raised last July. NT1 was the first product. It was like proof of concept. Then came the NT1C. That's the product that we have in production today. And the NT2 sampled in June, and we expect production to start in the first quarter of next year. We have over 60 active design wins. Many of them are coming from large customers. You can see the chart of our design wins. You can see the three colors here. The yellow one, that's when we started in 2002, second quarter, to get design wins for NT1. And then the green one, that's when NT1 went into production. You can see in Q4 03 we had one in production. Today we have 14. And we already have 30 design wins for NP2. So NP2 is achieving a lot of design wins in line cards. It's important to comment here that 14 customers in production for NP1, but only very few of them are generating real revenues. Only few of them reach the real production or volume phase. So EasyChip is still early in its revenues. Show me the money is also a little bit early. We are not certain about how our revenues will develop in the short term. It's based on NP1. You know, only maybe 3 or 4 of the 14 are generating real revenues. So 2 more and we will double. If 2 of them, you know, are not ordering, then revenues will go down. So we are not in a stable phase yet. So in summary, NP1 established EasyChip as the leader in high-speed network processors. That chip is really targeting the services card, one per box. At 130 nanometers and below, we believe that network processors and ASICs have similar price points, and therefore we believe that NPUs will replace ASICs because NPUs are flexible and ASICs are not. NP2 is our first step into the line card. We are targeting line cards in carrier boxes. NP3 is a line card in a chip, so that will be another cost reduction in carrier space, but will also take us into the enterprise space. And last, we focus now on the large customers, really the 5 big ones in the networking space, I would say, are Cisco, Huawei, Juniper, Nortel, and Alcatel, and 3 of them are NP2 customers already. And to conclude, system design can be hard or easy. Thank you.
I'll just stay in the audience here and ask a few questions. We're running a little late, but we may have time for a couple questions from the audience as well. Ellie, Fayed of Cavium made a compelling case, I think, about the evolution of the network, Internet 1, Internet 2, as he says. Now we're getting into more higher-level functionality with applications and content processing. And Fayed says that layers 2 through 4 are now being commoditized. First question, 1 is, are you being commoditized? 2, if you are, but you're the highest port density solution by far, is that such a bad thing? So that's a 2-part question.
So, you know, we are targeting the line card because we think that's where the volume is, and most line cards don't need to go beyond layer 4. That's true. But in layer 2 to 4, there is a lot of functionality that needs to be done, especially now that people are using a more sophisticated Ethernet, triple play. Quality of service needs to be a much more fine-grained. So those things cannot be done with ASICs. They need to be done with network processors, so programmability is important, but volume is there. So there are 10 times more line cards than a services card. All the layer 4 to 7 functionality can actually be done on the services card. So you can have one security processor there that will serve all the line cards. So that's
said, at the same time, you're obviously targeting what is a new, hot, growing market at layers 4 through 7. Your new Opteon chip, you know, I mean, you have everything under the sun on this chip, and it's, you know, it's quite an impressive feat with all the hardware acceleration and the multi-cores and so forth. So trying to do so many things on the same chip, obviously if someone wants all of that functionality, it's a great thing that they can find it in one place. But can you find the volumes at the right price points with such an ambitious product?
The interesting thing, first of all, is if you take a look at the area consumed by the general-purpose CPU elements, the 16, 64-bit CPUs, and you see what the overhead was to add compression-decompression, or pattern search, or security, these essentially are very, very small areas compared to the overall area dial. And we have two or three versions of the network services processor family. One, which is at the low end, which has no hardware acceleration, just number of cores. And at the highest end, you have all the hardware acceleration. And there's, again, a price difference because the chip sizes are different. So first, by varying the number of cores, kind of 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, you have a whole range of price points from kind of the low end to the high end. And then by varying in each point the number of hardware acceleration elements that you take, you also vary. That's another Z dimension, if you will, of ASP.
So these are the Opteon, they're three separate products then.
Three separate products, that's correct.
Are they all sampled?
The top two are sampling. The lowest end one is not yet sampled. It will be coming out very soon.
Questions? Go ahead.
Brad Templeton. So as far as Cavium is concerned, what you spoke about, many other people would say, goes completely in the face of what's become a pretty common Internet philosophy, that given names like the end-to-end principle and the concept of the stupid network. And you're advocating, at least not in your chips, I think there's a market for general high-performance chips that both of you are trying to make. But in the proposed applications you have, most of us would call it not Internet 2, but Internet minus 1. It's a reversal back to the old-style smart networks that were deliberately destroyed as a bad idea to be replaced by the stupid end-to-end network concept of the Internet that gave us all the bounty that we see here. Is it that you just totally disagree with that philosophy, that there's cyanide in our Kool-Aid, or is there another view that you were espousing that suggests we will revert back to the what we think is the crazy smart network concept?
I think what you're seeing now, for example, is you're going to have equipment that is essentially, you know, dumb equipment, if you will, sitting at maybe the core. But as soon as you go to the enterprise edge, just the layers of security processing, to give you an idea today, if you go into a network, as soon as the packet comes from the cloud, there's a network IDS box, which does pattern matching of intrusion detection. At the next step, there is a VPN firewall. It could be an IPsec VPN firewall. There is a DMZ zone and a LAN. Next to this VPN, IPsec VPN, there is an SSL VPN box. There's a network antivirus box. There is an SSL load balancer box. There are seven different boxes today that are essentially duplicating a lot of the same functionality. For example, in the network IDS box, what do you do first? You have to have I.O. So there is a cost of getting the I.O., the packet in, you open the packet, you do one function to it, close the packet, you move it to the next one. So each one of these successive, you know, five, six different boxes that are out there today, there's a lot of duplicated functionality, and administration and management of these six different boxes is a nightmare if you go and ask the MIS person, right? So by integrating the functionality, for example, on security services where the packet is opened once, and you do all the security services at that point, and then release a blessed packet out the other side, is giving huge amounts of price performance and power advantages compared to the existing solutions. And that's why we have all the... This is what is being called today as the UTM appliance, Unified Threat Management Appliance. And 2 years from now, you will not find a firewall box, or you will not find a VPN-only box. The only boxes that are going to be out there are UTM boxes that have all this functionality together. So there are areas where you still have very, very simple networks which are distributed, but on the other side, the network intelligence that needs to be added at the enterprise could be very, very well integrated, very cost-effectively into a single appliance.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, again, if you get people who have deep understanding of computer security properly drunk, they'll admit that firewalls are a hoax, right? That they're a really bad way to do computer security, and they're simply sold because everyone's running Windows, and therefore you don't have the option of actually doing computer security properly. So you're just banking on that continuing, and that's probably not a bad bet, I guess.
Yep. Could each of you give us a little sense of what you're seeing in the market? We obviously had a significant downturn several years ago in the telecom internet equipment space, but now we continue to see an explosion of gigabit Ethernet ports out there. We have the prospect of some of the American telephone companies rolling out significant new fiber networks with IPTV. Could you give us a little flavor, both in the U.S. and globally, about what you're seeing from the equipment companies?
Yeah, gigabit Ethernet is exploding. I think you said in one of your last reports that gigabit Ethernet exceeded fast Ethernet, and that just happened not long ago. So we are seeing a lot of that, and some people think that since we sell a 10 gigabit network processor, we sell 10 gigabit network processor just for 10 gigabit port, which is not the case. Most of the applications that we see are actually multiple 1 gigabit port. We are seeing boxes with 12 line cards in a chassis with 40 gigabit ports on each, so that's 4 network processors on each. So yeah, gigabit Ethernet is getting there, and I think that's going to continue.
The hardest things that we definitely see are layer 4 to layer 7 and security. So for example, if you take a look at the last 10 significant acquisitions in the box space, you take a look at Juniper. Juniper bought Terabit and Redline Communications, both really layer 4 to layer 7. If you take a look at Cisco, they've done a number of acquisitions in the layer 3 to layer 7 space. So the new really, really hot area for the market really is layer 4 to layer 7 applications. And also in the security area, layer 4 to layer 7 security, intrusion detection, intrusion prevention, antivirus, these type of applications are definitely getting very, very hot for networks moving on for the next 10 years.
I also have to agree with that. I mean, we are seeing security applications. We have several design wins in that space where the NT1C or the NT2 are used in conjunction with the Cavium security chip. And a lot of, I did not mention it, but both our processors, the NT1C and the NT2, can handle layer 5 to 7, so we can do all that URL filtering stuff, so, and the load balancing and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we are actually seeing design wins and activity in that space as well.
Yeah, I think if you take a look at it, the key, I think, difference in our approaches between EasyChip and Cavium is, for layer 4 to layer 7, we believe that what is really critically required is standard operating systems. If you have an application running, you need to be able to run it on Linux, VxWorks, the standard operating system. To have a more proprietary approach to it makes it a little bit more limiting, if you will. So we've kind of put our focus more on general-purpose CPUs, general-purpose architectures, general-purpose OSs, and then added hardware acceleration for 4 to 7.
Take one more question.
Hi. Celine Manger from PM Associates and CSPLB. I have a question regarding the whole area of security and how we have approached it over the years. It's been, piecemeal, one component at a time, and that has actually caused a lot more of the problems. Now we're looking at, and I'm not sure if there is a more systemic, more integrated approach that we don't leave security as an add-on, and we just start looking at it right at the forefront of the design of these systems. I am thinking of other MP processors. We had, 10, 9, around 2001, 2002 time frame. Now we're down to four major ones. I'm also looking at Intel. I'm more familiar with that. I've played with it a little bit. I'm looking at Intel 2800 series, for example, on the data plane, where they have integrated a security processor. And on the control plane, on the 400 series, they have done some other things. Can you comment on how your approach, each of you, taking care of this issue of piecemeal approach, and how you compare yourself to the Intel's approach? Thank you.
All right. If you take a look at Intel's approach, has been a standard network processor with microcode engines, a standard layer 2, layer 3 processor that does layer 2, layer 3 very well. But it has very limited amounts of L1 cache, no L2 cache, cannot have a standard operating system. So essentially, that particular product can do layer 2, layer 3 packet forwarding, QoS, some fine-grained traffic management very well, but it cannot run applications. So there is no general-purpose CPUs out there that you can just take an FTP application, an HTTP application, email, it cannot run on. So by taking that layer 2, layer 3, and adding security on it, like layer 3 security is what they've added, which is encryption, decryption. But security is a multi-layer problem, layer 3 to layer 7. If you just address the encryption piece, you've left the intrusion detection piece open and the antivirus open. So from a generic viewpoint, the difference essentially is we are focusing and delivering products for layer 3 to layer 7 of the network infrastructure, and Intel has addressed layer 2 and layer 3. So it's very, very different applications, number one. And number two, because of the general purpose nature of the processors that we have on board, you can run general purpose applications. So you can design a secure application because you have both the data services and the layer 3 to layer 7 security services at your control in one package. So you can design very, very tight formats. You can actually customize your operating system to have a variant of Linux that is much, much more secure, for example. So by having all these resources together, OEMs are really able to take advantage of this instead of just solving one layer of the problem and getting, you know, five other boxes to solve layer 4 to layer 7 problems.
I'll give you maybe an answer which is a little bit broader. I think that Intel will disagree that they are layer 2, 3. They will tell you that they are doing all seven layers. I think that there are two types of network processors, really. One type is the type that is based on multiple CPUs, general-purpose CPUs. In the case of Cavium, it's 1664 bytes. I think that Intel, the 2800 family, is also 1664 bytes. And this is one type. Network processors that are built from standard RISC machines. Then you have the specialized one, like EasyChip, that has a lot of small micro engines. So we have a lot more than 16. But they are specialized. They were built specifically to deal with high-speed packets that come in. Now, the second type, our, fit on line card. In a line card, the line rate is extremely important. You cannot delay packets. Packets come in, must go out, so you must work at wire speed. Where the other type will be found more on services cards, where packets come in, you do encryption, all the security stuff, they don't have to go out that quickly, so it's not 10 gigabit wire speed, it's not wire speed. But it's more flexible, it has those standard operating systems, and it will do all the advanced services. So those are two different types, and there is room for both.
Thanks so much. We're now lucky to have with us a popular speaker over the years at Telecosm. We'll get right to it. He's Tom Lee, a founder of Matrix and also a professor at Stanford. Tom.
Well, good afternoon. Since I am a professor, I suffer from a typical professor's disease, which is to probably belabor some points, and so forgive me if the first couple of slides contain definitions and not too many pictures. But I find that the words analog and digital are used very often, but sometimes we forget what they actually mean. So let me just offer quick definitions of some of these terms. The analog is found at interfaces with the physical world. So these are things like volts and pressure and those kinds of things. Digital is strong at computing and transforming, storing, doing things that involve basically regeneration of information. That's what's really good about digital, is you can make lots and lots of copies of things, and all the nth generation copies are just as good as the original. You can't say the same thing of a 100th generation Xerox copy, for example. There's a false dichotomy that analog and digital are somehow mutually exclusive or competitive or rivals or something like that. I don't find that to be true at all. They're definitely complementary. And I think it's interesting to observe that for the last several years, supposedly while we're in the digital age, analog has comprised about one-sixth of the revenue in the chip business, and that's actually higher than it was in the so-called analog age. So it's kind of interesting that we really are in an era where digital circuits and analog circuits really depend on each other. Now, we can talk about how signals can range from microvolts to megavolts for analog circuits. That's a much larger dynamic range than you encounter in digital circuits. Analog is very good at doing certain specialized functions while sipping nanowatts of power. The human ear is a spectacular example of this, where biology has evolved this remarkable apparatus that only consumes sort of 10 microwatts to do all the amazing things that the human ear is capable of. At the threshold of hearing, your eardrum is really displacing by a distance that's smaller than the diameter of a hydrogen atom. So that's a good microphone. And yet, you can sort of stand near a 747 at takeoff and still survive to hear small sounds the next day. Unfortunately, analog signals or analog circuits don't lend themselves very nicely to storage and replication without error. And that's why digital is very important. Digital typically has high power consumption per function, but what you get in exchange for that higher consumption is enormous flexibility. And that flexibility, of course, is incredibly valuable. And to that extent, it's sort of unnatural. So analog is from nature, and digital is not. And so you need both for a complete solution. Now, analog has been living and thriving in this digital age in various applications. Sensing is a huge one. I mean, if digital raison d'etre is to compute, that presupposes it's got some data to compute with. Where does that data come from? Well, it comes from the physical world. So you need sensors to feed things that can compute faster and faster with each passing generation of Moore's Law. Communication in both wireline and wireless contexts are always striving for higher data rates, but you're also getting beaten up on power dissipation. We want to push to higher and higher carrier frequencies in wireless. Supposedly there's this putative scarcity of spectrum, so there's an urgent need among some people to push to higher carrier frequencies. And once you've done the sensing and computation, you have to do something with the results of that computation. So increasingly, you want to do some control, some actuation, and some display function. So analog is intimately involved in all of those critical behaviors. And so we find ourselves doing some interesting things, marrying analog with digital. As just one of many possible examples, here is a new generation of gene chip or smart biosensor chip. You, I'm sure, have heard of Affymetrix and their gene chips and competitors' gene chips. And the idea is that you can perform multiple science experiments simultaneously in a very small area. So that greatly accelerates drug discovery, assays for various detections of pathogens and so forth. Well, the next generation actually embeds electronics in these gene chips. The word gene chip is a brilliant bit of marketing because it connotes circuitry. But actual gene chips that are shipping today don't have circuitry. They simply have some clever chemistry to convert a molecule counting problem into a light counting problem. And you simply use a camera and take a look at what's lighting up on these gene chips. Well, you'd like to do other sensing. There are some chemistries that just don't allow you to use that trick. And so you want to investigate, you want to probe the analyte electrically. So here's a way of doing exactly that. You can build an array of sensors, put a little droplet of analyte on there, and run thousands of experiments simultaneously on a very small chip. And so you can see what it looks like when you actually build it. The entire package is much smaller than a penny, with a correspondingly low cost. So these are the sorts of things that analog is now enabling. And, of course, once you've got all that data, you'll feed it to some digital engine to process things and say, you're healthy or you're going to die. So depending on the outcome of that news, you get a red light or a green light. The biosensor that I just showed you is capable of performing 2,000 analyses per square centimeter of dye area. So for a few dollars, essentially, of silicon, you can have a small lab on a chip that can do all these experiments. In fact, right now, it's kind of more experiments than we actually know how to perform. The other appeal is that you only need very tiny volumes of analyze, so you don't need to drain a liter of blood from your poor victim to figure out what's wrong. There are some other applications in the bio world that intersect very nicely with analog trends, and these include biomedical imaging. Everyone's familiar with ultrasound imaging, and you might not be aware of the fact that one part of ultrasound imaging really hasn't changed very much in three decades, and that's the basic sensor that's emitting and detecting the ultrasound energy. The type of detectors used in most of these systems are actually piezoelectric. These are minerals that have certain properties that allow you to whack them with a voltage and they physically deform. It's a phenomenon discovered by Pierre Curie before he married Marie. Well, there are some limitations with those materials. They're also very hard to work with just in terms of manufacturing. And if you want to build large arrays of them, you find out that you have to sort of go out on your own. You can't leverage the tremendous manufacturing knowledge of the chip industry, for example. So we wanted to change that. So we worked on a completely different form of emitter and detector, basically microscopic drums. But instead of beating them with a stick, you simply whack them with a voltage and you can cause a membrane to move. So you can create ultrasonic waves that way. And not only ultrasonic waves, but you can build arrays of these things because the drum heads, in this example, are made out of materials that are amenable to fabrication with ordinary integrated circuit process technology. So you can build nice arrays of these things. And of course, you always have to come up with some goofy losing abbreviation, CMUT, for capacitive micromachine ultrasonic transducer. So we can build CMUTs. So we can build them. Then what happens? Well, good things can happen. Here's an example of yesteryear's ultrasound images and what is enabled by these new capacitively micromachine transducers. On the left is something that you might have seen in the late 1970s, early 80s. You have enough resolving power to say, yes, there is a fetus there, and depending on the angle and how you light up the thing, you might be able to detect the gender and get it right more than half the time. On the right, as my standard joke is, not only can you identify the gender, you might even be able to detect its religion. So we have the ability with these new high-resolution sensors to evince a lot more, or to detect a lot more of what's going on there. And again, by using integrated circuit technology, we can actually bring down the cost at the same time we improve the quality of the image. Well, I'd like to switch gears a little bit because another important trend in analog is its application to wireless. We love wireless here at Telecosm. So let me talk about the four ages of wireless. You may not be familiar that there are four ages of wireless, but there are. So what's the first one? The first one was spark telegraphy. It was station to station. So you set up these sort of fixed points or semi-fixed points. You had telegraph operators work the keys, listen to the zorks and zaps that came over the headset. They had to filter out all the interference using their brains as signal processors, and hopefully the right message eventually gets delivered on foot or on bicycle to the final recipient. That's exactly how Marconi imagined wireless would work. It would be a point-to-point communications medium. Well, he was blindsided by the onset of the second age. He didn't bring it about. It just happened. Funny thing about technology is that occurs. It was so unprecedented, so unexpected, that there was no word to describe one station transmitting to many recipients. They had to steal a word from agriculture. The word is broadcasting, which everyone knows today as only a wireless term. But in 1900, it was a farming term. It meant the spreading of seeds. So broadcasting, the fact we had to appropriate the word from a different domain tells us just how unexpected its arrival was. So that was the second age, station to person. It was wildly successful, as we all know, because the capital expenditure to make this happen is relatively low. You build one big station, you get a bunch of advertisers to underwrite the programming, and you have cheap receivers that you can crank out en masse and thereby enable this huge market to evolve. much larger than Marconi ever imagined possible. Today, we're really in the thick of the third age of wireless, where we have peer-to-peer, person-to-person communication enabled by $100 or $200 billion of capital investment to build out the network infrastructure to enable this to occur pretty much anywhere on the planet now. So you say, well, isn't that it then? We're kind of done, people-to-people? You know, how could there be a fourth age? Well, I would argue that we could imagine the onset of a fourth age in which things talk to other things and perhaps talk to some of these other levels from the previous era. What might some of those things be? Well, we've already known about a lot of these. You can see this occurring slowly in bits and pieces, but I don't think anyone's ever put them into context. RFID tags, those represent one class of things communicating with other things. Various sensor networks that have been proposed. These are all examples of this emerging fourth age of wireless. Now, if we really want to kick this thing off, though, we have to do the same cost reductions that enabled microprocessors to become ubiquitous. We have to beat the cost down to nickels and pennies so that we could have, for example, you know, in a typical mid-sized passenger car today, I think you have between 2 and 3 dozen microprocessors. And if back in 1970 you'd gone to Gordon Moore and said, you know, in the year 2000, many cars will have a dozen or more microprocessors, he would have worried for your mental health and probably, you know, gently ushered you to the exit. And yet that's where we are today. And it was enabled entirely by massive cost reductions. And so very interesting things happen qualitatively to the universe when the cost gets down to those kinds of values. So here are some graphics that help us show what might occur if we can traverse that size reduction tree. On the left is a dual-mode Wi-Fi chip. It's 802.11a and b. It's roughly state-of-the-art. It's about as good as they are today. And just the analog and RF stuff consumes about 70 square millimeters of silicon, and making some assumptions about wafer cost and yield, that's roughly $10 for that. That's the manufacturing cost, and then, of course, after it goes through the channel a couple times, it changes hands. Who knows what that ends up retailing for. Bluetooth thought to do a little bit less. It was less ambitious than Wi-Fi, and so the chip is correspondingly smaller and cheaper, a couple of bucks. You say, well, that's great. And yet we don't find Bluetooth taking the world by storm as had been predicted for Bluetooth. Apparently a couple of bucks and the performance that goes along with it aren't compelling enough to really kick off the exponential explosion folks were hoping for. So then we try it again. That didn't work. Let's strip away even more functionality, get the cost down further. Now we have this thing called Zigbee, a dollar. And maybe that's the right number. Maybe a dollar will kick it off. But I would argue, if you're unsure about a dollar, let's shoot for 10 cents. If 10 cents is achievable, well, I would say that at that point, people aren't going to work real hard to justify whether or not they have to use it. They'll just stick it into things for the hell of it. As an example, my nephews love their blinking LEDs in their tennis shoes. They just love it. And all their classmates love blinking LEDs in tennis shoes. Now, I don't know who thought of this, but it was brilliant. I can't imagine some gallium arsenide foundry operator saying, hey, I know what let's do. Let's put blinking gallium arsenide photon emitters in children's shoes. And yet, it was huge. So when things get cheap enough, you start doing foolish things like that, and why the hell not? So the idea here behind what we're calling 0G, kind of as a tongue-in-cheek joke and a little jab at 3G, is the 0G chip is a 1 square millimeter radio that has the performance of Bluetooth. It's actually better than Bluetooth, and yet costs under a dime and requires no external components other than a battery, a crystal, and an antenna. So we're talking dirt cheap, very small. You can stick it in anything, put it in cereal boxes just for fun. Well, of course, you have to trade off something. And a typical problem in making cheap, small radios is that they don't perform very well. And one reason they often don't perform very well is that there's self-interference. There's things like noise on a chip. There's fundamental noise as well as noise that's sort of an artifact of using cheap technologies like CMOS, as well as the inability to match two things perfectly on a chip. Even though they match pretty well, it turns out the level of matching you require for some architectures is not just pretty well. You need to match them exquisitely well, and it turns out you can't get that. And so one example is a thing called DC offset. And normally DC offsets, this is sort of an error, might be measured in millivolts. And milli sounds small. But unfortunately, the signals at the antennas might be microvolts. So milli is small on an absolute level, but it's huge on a relative level. So you have to figure out a way of not having these built-in error terms just clobber the signals you're trying to detect. So there's a very simple solution. Well, if it hurts when you do that, doctor, doctor, don't do that. All you have to do is simply shape the spectrum of the data signal so that you don't have an unfortunate coincidence of its spectral peak lining up with all these bad things. And so provided you do that, which is readily done by simple coding tricks, which is a digital and software activity, then you can work around the impairments of the analog part. So again, here's another example where these are complementary arts rather than competitive arts. All right, so let's suppose we can build cheap radios. Is that it? Is that the end game for analog? We just end up making consumer things that are disposable radios? Well, that's one possible future. I would say that's one branch of many possible futures. Another completely 180 degrees out, or as many orthogonal dimensions as you care to apply, somewhere along the axis of expensive is terahertz electronics. What are terahertz? Well, they're above gigahertz. And there's this interesting terahertz gap, which resides between the highest conventional wireless frequencies and the lowest conventional optical frequencies. And just to put some numbers on this, perhaps we might be talking about 100 gigahertz to perhaps 30,000 gigahertz. And that band of frequencies turns out to be not very well served by any technology. Semiconductors can't do very well up there, and it turns out traditional optical techniques don't scale downward in frequency with a whole lot of grace. So there's this uncomfortable zone that's been not very well served by any existing technology. But it turns out there are many compelling applications for terahertz electronics. So if we can just get the technology in the hands of people who have already identified applications, then we can kick off a whole other interesting industry. And it's happening, but only in little bits and pieces. Well, why do we care? Well, here's some possible reasons. The standard one for nerds is because it's there. There's a gap, and by golly, we've got to fill it. Well, there's a less flippant reason, of course. There are absurd amounts of available spectrum in the terahertz band. If we talk about things that are normalized to percentages of a carrier frequency, well, as the carrier frequency goes up, the absolute amount of spectrum you've got to play with is huge. So if you're looking at 100 gigahertz plus or minus 10%, that's 20 gigahertz of free space to play with. You can do a lot of good stuff in that kind of bandwidth. On top of that, it turns out that you can do imaging that's very similar to X-ray imaging, except without the hazards of using an ionizing radiation like X-rays. So we can image through some distance in tissue. We can identify certain pathologies that are not very well imaged by other modalities or would entail a risk that is not justified by the putative benefits. So this is a huge application, and I'll have more to say about that in a couple of slides. People have already identified that you can detect incipient skin cancers before they become a life-threatening condition. Today, there is no net benefit in sort of routinely scanning people with X-rays because you'll probably induce more cancers than you'll catch. That's not so good. But with terahertz waves, that trade-off doesn't exist. So I predict in the not-too-distant future, a standard scanning will occur just to make sure you don't have some skin cancers just waiting to erupt. Dental caries. With X-rays, you pretty much can only detect a cavity after there's nothing you can do about it except drill and fill. With terahertz, you can actually detect when the tissue is starting to degenerate, but there's still something you can do to remediate it. And that's a huge thing. And once again, by not using ionizing radiation, you can image more frequently. You don't have to worry so much about juvenile nervous systems being affected by routine X-rays because you're not using X-rays. So it's a hugely important technology just waiting to be developed. Because of its penetrating power, you can image through opaque objects like clothing. So for security applications, you can detect whether the bulge is just a fat wallet or something a little more ominous. Now, of course, there are all sorts of privacy questions that society will have to deal with, but having the technology available at least gives us the luxury of having that debate. On top of this imaging capability, and in contradistinction to X-rays, rather than just being able to detect sort of a density map, whether it's bone versus flesh, It turns out that many molecules of security, environmental, and medical interest happen to have resonances. They sort of light up when illuminated by terahertz energy. So not only do you get sort of this density map that you already get in X-rays, we can actually say something about the chemical environment. The pharmaceutical companies are very interested in being able to use this, for example, as a quality control step to make sure that something hasn't gone wrong in their synthesis vat, so that the wrong polytype of something hasn't accidentally been released to the consumer with dire effect. So you can actually resolve those kinds of things. You can also answer questions like, is the thing that I'm looking at inside this package silly putty, modeling clay, or is it plastic explosives? Right now, you don't get that answer very easily and not very quickly. But with terahertz waves, you can get that answer pretty much instantaneously, and you can imagine doing real-time scanning of all mail and all packages using these devices if we get the cost down to the point where that's made practical. Well, if we focus, for example, just on the communications aspect, we do have a few challenges. I won't call them problems, but there are some challenges. This is a plot of attenuation as a function of frequency, and the plot ends at 400 gigahertz. We're not even really deep into the terahertz regime. But you can see that aside from this sort of wavy fine structure, there's a general upward trend, meaning it gets harder and harder to get a signal from point A to point B as you crank up the frequency. The atmosphere, both oxygen and water vapor, absorb more strongly as you crank up the frequency. And that's a general trend. So that means if we want to keep the same communication systems, we're just going to have to put out more power from the transmitting end. And that sounds like a pretty reasonable thing until you realize that that's really hard. As frequency goes up, semiconductors just poop out. That's an IEEE term meaning poop out. And what happens is that due to several reasons, as Moore's law advances, we're getting these advances by shrinking the devices. But if we shrink the devices, they just blow up more easily. And so it turns out getting power out of them gets progressively harder, and in fact, more than quadratically more difficult as we increase the frequency. And so if we're looking at terahertz frequencies, power output, available power output drops down to the milliwatt and microwatt range, which is still something that you can do things with, but we could do many more things if we could get more power. And unfortunately, this seems to be kind of tied up with the physics of devices, at least semiconductors, as we know them today. And so there doesn't seem to be anything we can do at the device level to address this problem. This is more or less a tough nut to crack. So you've got to play a different game. And one possible different game is simply to use the integrated circuit philosophy of, well, throw transistors at the problem and cross your fingers that that solves it. And one way to do this is to take a bunch of feeble amplifiers and combine them so that the net behavior is that of one gargantuan device. That's a simple principle. It's devilishly hard to pull off in practice. Folks at Caltech have done a beautiful job with something that I'm calling the Rutledge Grid Amplifier, named after Carver Mead's brilliant colleague, Dave Rutledge. And his idea was, well, let me just build this big array of little amplifiers. I'll just shine in feeble energy on one end, and I'll have stronger stuff come out the other end. I'll just use three states to combine these energies. It's really analogous to having a whole bunch of little flashlights all light up together, behaving as one large flashlight. And to prevent the output from coupling to the input and causing an oscillation or some other unwanted behavior, we'll simply use polarizers to make sure that they're orthogonally disposed, and so even if some energy from the output works its way back to the input, it's unlikely to do anything particularly harmful. And this has a very interesting property that the spacing between amplifiers is normalized to wavelength. So as we crank up the frequency and the wavelength shrinks, we'll have these things more densely packed together, but the overall, we could just simply add more elements and keep the overall dimension constant. And it turns out that the since the area held fixed here, and we're talking about increasing the number of devices per linear dimension, the number of devices in total grows quadratically. The quadratic growth in the number of devices turns out to compensate exactly for the quadratic drop in the per-device power. So you get roughly constant total watts for a given size plate for this thing. So that's a very nice property of these grid amplifiers. They work fantastically well. So it's potentially solvable, or using this kind of technique that in another few generations of Moore's Law, that we might be able to use a grid approach like this to give us sufficient output power to do some of these interesting applications without having to have a refrigerator-sized piece of gear that requires a team of PhDs around the clock to keep it from blowing up which is the case there. Another possibility is to go back to the past, because it turns out that today we're facing limitations that are qualitatively similar to the limitations that faced radio and radar engineers on the eve of World War II. There the problem was, how do we launch energies at 1,000 megahertz, which at that time was just a hugely, it was such a high frequency that they had to call them microwaves. And they wanted thousands of watts so that they could be able to detect airplanes that were measured in tens of kilometers or even 100 kilometers distance. So turns out they were able to solve these through non-traditional techniques using electron beams shot through a vacuum. It's an oversimplification, but it's more true than false to say that it probably helps you not to force electrons to bash their way through a solid, which is what we're insisting that electrons do today in a transistor. So by launching electrons at a good fraction of the speed of light through a vacuum, you at least give yourselves a fighting chance at very high frequency operation. So in the late 1930s, using man-made manual structures with machine things that people with ordinary human-sized hands operated, they were able to build things that put out thousands of watts at gigahertz frequencies using things that have critical dimensions measured in millimeters. So the dumbest proposal is, okay, let's just shrink all millimeters to microns, and okay, maybe the power goes down, but maybe that gets us to terahertz, and we go from kilowatts to watts. And it turns out that's probably doable. And so we find ourselves in the semiconductor age looking back in history at the vacuum tube era for inspiration, and then combine the manufacturing part of silicon machining and integrated circuit technology and merging them with device concepts that are over a half century old to solve this problem. And again, from JPL, we find one of many proposals that folks are now seriously investigating at building now what you've got to call it nano something, right? So this is a nano klystron, and hopefully nano klystrons give you mega goodness. And so here's an example where, again, you just simply build this thing out of micromachine silicon parts. And just for more cachet, we're going to use carbon nanotube cathodes to emit the electrons instead of glowing filaments of tungsten. And it looks like simulations are telling us we'll be able to get milliwatt, perhaps tens of milliwatt output powers at terahertz frequencies, which would be a revolution. If you could build that, then you could imagine sort of a Palm Pilot-sized device that you could just sort of shine at things, and on that screen you could see whatever it is that you were looking for. And that would really revolutionize this entire terahertz business, kick it off in ways that we probably can't even predict. But it's really the last important wireless frontier. That terahertz gap is waiting to be bridged, and there are lots of folks who have realized this and are working day and night to bridge that gap. Just to give you some examples of what people have achieved in lab, well, first for comparison, here's one of the first x-rays that Wilhelm Röntgen published in January of 1896. So that's an x-ray, simple density map, basically, of the material that the x-rays are passing through. In the middle is an actual terahertz image of a tooth suffering tooth decay. So not x-rays, it's actually terahertz waves, and you can see very clearly sort of the light pinkish blob in the middle. That's an area that has now incipient dental caries. But it's actually at a point where you could remediate it. And that's nice. It's no longer a drill and fill option. There's a third option, which is to let it heal. And on the right is an example of a very crude terahertz. It's actually not a fairly long wave terahertz system. But nonetheless, you can image through clothing. This guy was fully clothed, actually. He's wearing a heavy overcoat. And you can see on the lower left, there's a concealed weapon. And so this is the kind of thing that is enabled by terahertz. So it allows you to have many of the properties of x-ray imaging, but without the health drawbacks of x-rays. And so this is, as I say, just awaiting cheap enough technologies to really kick this off in a high gear. So in closing, you know, this is just a small sampling of what analog is up to these days. It's delivering ever better sensors for biomedical imaging, for environmental sensing, for automotive applications. You name it, sensors are a big deal, and analog is right there dealing with those basic sensor signal conditioning. I argue that the fourth age of wireless is right upon us. It's, we're close to the hockey stick of that. The technologies now are here. I think there are compelling applications already identified for the fourth age of wireless. So just you wait when suddenly You wake up one morning and you'll find that your house is just filled with microscopic radios, and you didn't even know how it happened. The terahertz gap is being bridged right now. Everyone's hard at work figuring out how to make stuff smaller, cheaper, less flaky. That's going to happen. It's just engineering. There's no fundamental physical barrier that's preventing us from getting there. It's just good old-fashioned hard work, and there are people working hard, so it's going to happen. So I guess I would summarize by saying, by stealing a line from a song by Timbuktu, "The future's so bright, I've got to wear shades." Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Tom. If anyone has any questions, you can catch up with Tom during the break. And we're going to go ahead and take a coffee break right now. And don't forget to join us downstairs for the 2:50, somewhere 3 o'clock to 3:30, Fiber to the Home, the FTTH Industry, and AmMedia Networks.